All right, so welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. I'm Jeffrey Higgins. This is my wife Cynthia's in my restaurant. It's all based on my wife's family recipes from Alexandria, Egypt. We've turned this into a literary salon as a hub and a safe place for authors in the D.C. area. I believe, I'm losing count at this point, I believe you're the 211th author I've interviewed.
Holy cow. We also
partner with Mystery Writers of America and Sisters in Crime and a bunch of different writing groups. We have dozens of book clubs that come in here. So it's really become a place for writers to come and meet and discuss all the things they need to know.
I'm impressed.
Check out our podcast. Hope Gibbs is our PR director here. She has us number one on Apple and Spotify. Get out to about 1.5 million people a month.
Wow.
You can see all of our, I believe we have 70 or 80 podcasts that are up online now. So you can check them out. So they're really fun. I'm excited about this one because I love techno thrillers.
Oh, cool.
All right. So Richard H. Smith is a futurist, technologist, and science policy expert whose career spans more than 30 years at the forefront of emerging technology and strategic forecasting. He's worked alongside scientists, engineers, Fortune 50 companies, and the U.S. international governments on issues ranging from nanotechnology and artificial intelligence to healthcare innovation and climate change. Richard has served as a research director at a major university medical center, founded multiple technology companies, and advised organizations on how disruptive technologies reshape societies, markets, and governments. Not a small topic there. He is formally trained in climate change science by Al Gore and continues to teach courses on sea level rise and climate futures. Raised in Virginia, he built his professional life while raising a family, an experience that deeply influences the emotional stakes of his fiction. He now resides in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, a coastal community already experiencing the effects of rising seas and intensifying storms. He's here to discuss his techno thriller, White Grass. So please welcome Richard Smith.
Thank you.
So this is fun. So let's start off by, I have so much I want to talk to you about.
Okay.
Why don't you give us a little bit of what the book is about, a little back jacket copy without any spoilers.
Okay. No spoilers. Well, it takes place 22 years from now. So within the lifetime of most of the people watching this, certainly all of our children and grandchildren. And I wanted to make it far enough in the future that climate change could have an effect on our lives more than it's even having today. And that's a great deal. But it also had to be far enough away that we could do some fun things with technology. And the science is all good. It's not like a fanciful science fiction fantasy kind of thing. It's all good science based on climate change, but mostly based on a family and how it deals with the possibility of solving climate change with a technology that could also be weaponized if it got in the wrong hands. So that's where the techno thriller part comes in. And it reads like a movie. And in fact, I've written a screenplay to go along with it.
Have you really?
Have you?
Is this your first novel, correct?
It is my first novel.
And so when you screenplay, it's a completely different medium. So
it is
really difficult to do.
And I had no idea how to do it. So thank goodness for AI teaching me formatting.
Did you use what was the software you use? Did you actually, because you're screenwriting, Final Draft.
Final Draft, yeah.
Yeah, that's why I think 90-something percent.
Tab, enter, yeah.
It makes life easy.
It sure did.
Did you find it was hard for your own book when you're adapting?
Very hard.
Because you know so much about the characters and the depth, and you're dropping down to, 110 pages?
123 so far, but I've got another draft to go through. I'm hoping to get it down to about 110, which is what makes it difficult from a feeling perspective, because there's so much in the book that I love, and it's 360-odd pages, and I have to cut it down to 110. There's a lot of meat, a lot of fun stuff that I love that I have to throw away.
I think that's why Hollywood stays away from authors adapting their own work generally.
I think you're
because
probably
it is so
right.
Hard. You almost know too much, right?
Yes.
Which is similar, I guess, to being an expert in the fields that you are when you know so much. Do you find I can see the parallel. If you're sitting down at a cocktail party with somebody and they're asking you about some emerging technology,
right?
Do you find it hard to start when someone has no base knowledge?
It is. But what the rule that I try to follow is the Feynman rule. If you can explain it to your grandmother, you've done a decent job. If your grandmother doesn't understand it, neither does the person that you're talking to. So I try to use that rule, and it serves me pretty well.
That's a real skill, though, right? I mean, when you're taking complex ideas and, you know, especially when you're talking about like technology and you're a futurist,
right?
Looking, you have to, like when you're talking with colleagues, you all have a certain base knowledge. You have to be able to assume some things.
And you know the same shorthand, et cetera.
Right. So when you're starting new, do you find you have to be at the beginning, you have to give like a minute or something of just base knowledge so you can like the building blocks that you can get to the idea you actually want to talk about?
And I have to admit that in my spare time, I've also written a children's version of White Grass. And that was using that skill that we're talking about right now, almost once upon a time. And the title of the children's version is Augie and the Tiny Little Sky Helpers. So nanotechnology becomes a tiny sky helper that eats the too much air.
How much is nanotechnology going to change all of our lives in the near future?
Well, I've thought for 30 years now that it's going to change virtually everything. It's already changing materials as we know them. If you recall from Star Trek, the original series, the concept of transparent aluminum, it now exists because of nanotechnology. So in the material science area, you've got all of the kinds of things that it can do there. But it's also going to be used in 3D printing. Combining that with nanotechnology, we'll be eating printed food at Elaine's restaurant in 20 years. I guarantee it.
Not if my wife can help. Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I think it is the same thing with like artificial intelligence, right?
Yes.
Like how it's going to affect every aspect of society. And do you find now that you're in the literary world, do you find that people in this world are a little less knowledgeable or a little more resistant to new technologies?
I'm not sure that they're resistant to new technologies in general. I think they are. There is a lot of resistance to AI in the literary community. I know that when I started working on the screenplay, I wanted for AI to write it for me because I'm kind of lazy that way. But I knew that I couldn't do that because I couldn't get away with it, because people will know ultimately if it's being written by a person or by an AI. And AIs are getting better and better and better. And for things like formatting and storing information and rearranging things, AI is wonderful. Thank goodness it didn't exist when I wrote the book, because I probably would have leaned on it instead of leaning on myself for 7 years.
It'll cause copyright problems for sure.
No question.
Using it for creation.
I understand that if it is written by AI, it is not copyrightable.
That's true.
That's true today.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, we'll see how things change in the future.
Right.
But as we speak, that is absolutely true. Yeah. All right. So going back to your book, you're calling it a techno thriller, which I think is spot on, but it's also near future technology. When you're going into near future, so it's so close to what we have now.
Right.
Did that like scratch an itch that you have based on your professional background, where you're able to play around a little bit with some of the things that you know are coming?
Absolutely. One of the technologies in the book is no age, and that is a medical technology that allows you to stop aging at whatever age you happen to be at the time you take the treatment. I set it at 40 in the book as the maximum, and in fact, one of the non-major characters dies before the book starts from taking no age after she was too old to take it. So that's one interesting play that I got to do that I don't think you can say is on the immediate horizon, but I think we're getting close to it. And there are plenty of very smart people who are working on life extension, but it's not just your life expectancy, it's your health expectancy.
And are you thinking this is based on like nanotechnology, like having, you know, small robots in the bloodstream,
absolutely,
like catching cancers early? Or is it more like understanding like mitochondria and understanding how your cell works and how it starts to die with age?
Both of the above, and both of those in combination.
It's fascinating, right?
It is indeed.
you're in an interesting field, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So who is the readership for this? Like when you're writing, do you have a reader in mind? Like, do you know? I know, like in general, techno thrillers are skew slightly more male, even though most readers are female.
Right.
Do you know who's picking up this book?
I think that I have a number of very strong female characters, so I hope that it'll have more of a female readership than the typical technology-based thing, because it really is, it's based on the Marshall family. Greg is the scientist who does the invention of whitegrass, which is nanotechnology to absorb sunlight and water and send it off to the local community and that kind of thing. And he also invents Icarus, which is what eats the CO2 in the atmosphere. So Greg is the scientist. Jenny is his wife. She's an AI programmer, PhD, and she's going to teach an AI, an Android AI that we bring into the book about halfway in. Then we have Jimmy and Lizzie, the two teenage kids. Jimmy is kind of the heart of the book, and Lizzie is the soul. And so it's a story of the family and how they progress through having the bad guys find out about their invention and trying to steal it from them and not willing to, not having any bars at all. They're willing to rob, steal, kill to get this technology because they can then use it for blackmail. They can actually blackmail whole countries with this technology if they can get their hands on it.
So when you're talking about technology that like pulls CO2 from the air or yeah. things that have like global implications, what are in the real world,
okay.
like which I'm sure you address in your book too, right? But what are like the ethical considerations when you're talking about whether it's a country, a government, a national government, or businesses, right, that are working, that are doing something that will have like these externalities?
That's the principal question that the book asks. Who's going to be in control? And who gets to decide? Who gets to decide?
Because I mean, we've heard these ideas in the past too, right? Pumping chemicals into the atmosphere
sure.
to reduce the sun's rays and
right.
things. And it always occurs to me that since nobody actually knows what the ramifications of that would be when you're talking about like complex systems.
Right. Well, I'm actually going to teach a course in the fall on science fiction to inform public policy, and I'll use whitegrass as a textbook for that course. There'll be a lot more too, but we're going to talk about questions exactly like that one.
So, in so many ways, people are like, we're in a tough political moment, right?
Where, yes.
And people tend to choose teams as opposed to looking at ideas. But when you write in fiction, I've found that people tend to open themselves up more because they're looking through the eyes of these fictional characters. And
right.
because it's fiction, they're able to actually understand maybe what somebody else they previously disagreed with are believing.
Mm-hmm.
In science fiction, you also see a lot of science fiction driving technology, right? Like you can
Absolutely.
Go back and look at the technology we have now and find the novelist who wrote about it 30 or 40 years ago, right?
Correct.
So why is that in science fiction? Why do you think science fiction is like, are scientists when they're younger reading these things and saying, oh, I want to create that?
Oh, I think, yeah, I think for sure. But then when people go into science, they're forced down a path of slicing the salami as thin as possible. It's a term of art they use in academia to describe people becoming PhD scientists. They have to take a large question and make it as small as they possibly can in order to do research and prove a point on that issue. But that's not what fiction writers do. Fiction writers take the small thing and make it big so we can see what are the possibilities? What could we do with nanotechnology if we had it? Not what can we do to write this next paper. So there's a lot more creativity allowed.
So do you think with scientists, it's more because when you're using a scientific method, you have to limit variables to actually try to see efficacy, right, in what,
sure.
what you're doing? Or is it also driven by like things where maybe we're not thinking about, like grants, like money behind research,
money
know, what
drives,
people are looking for?
Yeah. By necessity, money drives a lot of it. Now, most of the money for scientific research traditionally has come from government, at least in the United States. There is an organization called the XPRIZE. I don't know if you've heard of it or not. It was founded by Peter Diamandis, I don't know if you know him, and I won't go into his biography, but the XPRIZE is a bunch of investors who put their money into big science projects that give us a positive future. The last XPRIZE that was given out was for, ready for this, removing CO2 from the atmosphere. They gave $100 million in grants for people to come up with ways to do what Icarus does in Whitegrass. Now, the people at XPRIZE and I have had some conversations because my book is about what they just gave out $100 million to do. And not because of me, but totally coincidentally, they have a competition going on as we speak for people to write a trailer, to produce a trailer for a movie, a 3-minute movie trailer for a 2-hour movie. There are 5,000 applicants for this contest. And of course, I'm applying with Whitegrass. And the funny thing about that is that the top 10 finalists will be given 10 days starting a month from now to write a screenplay. And so you can't write a screenplay in 10 days. So I started writing mine a while back. And I'm done with it, with the first draft of it now.
I mean, why not? You're doing children's books, adult novels, you know, screenplays. You might as well jump in with both.
And I'm working on a sequel.
So like when you're just, I mean, without, I don't want to get into any spoilers in your book, but when you're talking about like, CO2 is necessary for life.
Sure.
You know, so when you're talking about removing that from the atmosphere, right, there could be some unintended consequences. Could there not?
Probably not, because CO2 is a tiny component of the atmosphere. So removing some of it is not going to make a difference in the big scheme of things. But that tiny percentage that CO2 is causing the global warming that we're seeing, the bigger storms than we've ever seen before, the forest fires that are going out of control. The heat wave in Europe that's going on right now, these are caused by that extra CO2 that's in the atmosphere. When I started looking at it 30 years ago or so, there were something like 250 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. It's now 700. And it's not 700 now. It's going to be 700 22 years from now. But it's way over 400, 500 now. And it's what is able, even in such small amounts, to cause that much difference in the weather.
So when you're writing this book, part of it is because you have a mission, right? That you want,
yes,
you're trying to educate people about your beliefs in this area. How do you, when you're writing techno thrillers, so you're writing entertainment, right? That's your vehicle to get people to pay attention.
Right.
How do you balance your views on this with story? Like how do you balance giving information, but also keeping like plot and pacing and, you know,
right,
all the elements, the techniques of entertainment. How do you balance that?
Have you ever done an acrostic?
No.
An acrostic is like a crossword puzzle, and it gives you clues and you fill in your answer to the clue like you would in a crossword. But the letters in that clue form other words.
Oh, yeah, I have done that.
Okay.
Didn't know that's what it was called.
Okay. Yes. So I used to do those all the time. I would do those, and then I'd go skiing and ski until 10 o'clock at night up in Maryland or Pennsylvania, which can't do so much anymore because there's not much snow anymore because of global warming. Mm-hmm. But put that aside. With acrostics, you work from the clue about the question and the words and the letters and the words. And you go back and forth and back and forth. And that's what I did, story and technology. I wanted the story to tell this about the family. I needed the technology to do that to allow this story to happen. So I just iterated back and forth. And it took a long time, but I think it worked.
What were the parameters that like you gave yourself for how much of each you could do before you had, like, as you're telling a story with the family, right? You have to give the science, right? Because it's relevant. But at one point, did you say, okay, I'll do a paragraph at a time, I'll do a page, like, you know, how much before you're realizing you're info dumping or you're putting too much in? Like, what was that trigger in your mind?
Trying to remember that part of it, I would just sit down with the idea for this is the feeling that I want to convey today. Mm-hmm. This is how I want people to react to this particular family member or, excuse me, what have you. And then I would just start typing on my cute little MacBook Air. And I would type for hours, and it just kind of rolled out. When you ask about process, I didn't really have a formal process. I just started having a conversation in my head and put the conversation into my fingers and kept going until I got tired.
Well, that approach you have with, you know, what do I want them to feel, right? That is absolutely the right thing. So in the end, you're trying to create emotion in your reader. And I just asked specifically about like the technology and the science, because you see that with a lot of like historical fiction authors. You see that with a lot of science authors, because you have to give people the information.
Right.
But if you do too much of it, their eyes roll back in their head, right? So you see this in like narrative nonfiction, where somebody will be telling, you know, it's nonfiction, but it'll be told in the technique of fiction, right? So,
yes.
So, you know, there was like, I'm trying to remember, like the Hot Zone. I don't know if you've ever read that, right?
Definitely.
It's Preston. Wonderful. Yeah. Right, absolutely. Right. Preston. So it's a, you know, couple of paragraphs of this, a little bit of the stuff you need to know, then back into the story.
Right. When I was a professional futurist some years ago, I had one project for a government agency, one of the three-letter agencies, and my job was to tell them what bad guys could do if given certain capabilities. And I wrote it in a series of chapters, each of which was totally self-contained. And I told a story about who the bad guys were. And then I told what this technology might be used for if the bad guys could get their hands on it. And then I told a little bit more about the story. And one particular chapter of that, the government customer paid $110,000 to my firm for. And I thought, that's pretty good job for a day, right? 6 months later, and in that story, I used ancient Greek technology called steganography, where you hide things in plain sight. They would actually hide words in the text that they put on the slates, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I used that technology today to hide the floor plan of an embassy in a pornographic image and put it on the internet. And there's so much porn, there's no way that anybody could screen all of it. And that's how they could get it through anybody that's looking for top secret information.
Is that what you told your wife? Yeah. It's a research project.
Yeah,
I swear.
Yeah. Debbie does Santa Fe, I think it was. Anyway,
but that technology was even used in World War II.
It
right?
was. It absolutely was. So 6 months after I gave that report to them, there's an article in the Washington Post. So and so agency gets $3 million from U.S. Senate for steganography.
Oh, that's funny.
But that was exactly the technique that I used.
So when you're doing that, when you're predicting, how much of it is you're looking at the technology as it stands today and what can be done with it,
mm-hmm.
and how much of it is looking forward and how will this technology change? How will people change chemical compounds? How will some new, like, how do you predict that new technology?
I don't like to use the word predict, because when you're dealing with the future as a futurist, you can forecast different scenarios and you can say, if this, then that. Predicting is something that mentalists do, and, sure. and I don't like to do that. But how do we forecast things? Looking at what's available today, and I'm looking at it from the viewpoint of a technology forecaster, mm-hmm. Not so much a social technology person. Although I have friends who do that, and I think it's very admirable. My focus was always technology. What can I do today? What do the people who are writing about it think that it might be able to do tomorrow? What would I do with it if I were in charge of it? And then to let the mind expand and then set up other parameters to go along with it, because nothing happens in a vacuum. You have technology moving at mostly these days exponential paces, but you've also got social factors, economic factors, environmental factors, other things that are all moving at the same time. So if you just look at the technology, you're going to miss the mark every time. So taking a look at a number of different phases of society and where we are and moving them along each in its own pace, then I think you can come up with a better forecast.
So just mentioning like the variables you just talked about, it seems like you're okay, let's look at economics, right? Yeah. Every time you add one of those, it has to significantly like decrease your accuracy level, doesn't
sure.
it?
Absolutely.
So is within forecasting, I'm not saying predicting, within right. forecasting, is there like a level of accuracy that people generally have in the field, and how does it relate to time? You know, what's that temporal element? Like how much does it go down? Like how far out? And what level of accuracy? It seems like because there's so many variables
sure.
there, even at, over like a year, you would start running into serious problems.
One thing that I used to do when I was doing it for a living, if I want to look 20 years out, I start by looking 20 years back, but things are not going to advance at the same rate. They're accelerating. In most fields, they're accelerating. I just totally lost my thought.
So just the temporal element of prediction
yeah.
or of forecasting.
Think about hurricanes, mm-hmm. and you watch the weatherman, and the weatherman says, this is where we are today, and this is where we're going to be next week, and it expands out, mm-hmm. and you've got a zone of probability, and that's kind of like it is with forecasting. Mm-hmm. With a hurricane, you're looking out in terms of days. With futuristic forecasting, you're looking at usually in terms of years, but it's the same process. The further out you go, the wider the zone of unlikelihood becomes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And what's the efficacy? Like if you go back and look at futurists from 20 years ago, like
okay.
you said, you go back and look, like how close were they with where we are today? Because it's some of it seems like is predictable.
Well,
right?
If you're talking about guys like Isaac Asimov, mm-hmm. he was right on target. The things that he forecast way back then are and have been coming true. Feynman was pretty good at figuring out what was going to happen in the future, in his future. I'm trying to think of someone else. Ray Kurzweil. Ray Kurzweil is a writer. He worked at Xerox PARC, I believe, in the early days, but he's been predicting predicting exponential growth in technology. There's a term for it that I'm losing, but technology, well, take computers, for example, improving the capability of computers, doubling roughly every year and a half, mm-hmm. and the price cutting in half roughly by the same thing, about a year and a half, cutting it in half. But it's accelerating, and we're getting to the point, let me draw a picture real quick. And I'll put it up so the camera can see it. Exponential growth. I'm just doing a graph. And it starts out like this. And then it does this. So it starts out way at the bottom here. And it doesn't look like anything's happening. Year after year, it doesn't look like that much is happening. But it doubles every time. I'm reminded of the story of an ancient Shah who wanted his daughter to be married, so he was hiring someone to arrange the marriage, and so far everyone was being unsuccessful. So a new guy came along and he said, tell you what, I will guarantee to get your daughter married. And all you have to pay me is one grain of rice per day until the wedding. One grain of rice per day is all I ask. And it took 3 years, but every day it doubled. And by the third year before the daughter got married, the Shah could not afford the fee because it got so big over time. That's what's happening with technology today. And that's what I am trying to think about when you ask about who could predict it. Well, Kurzweil was the one who wrote this theory, and he's been right over and over and over again.
When quantum computing becomes more stable,
yeah,
how is that going to affect this?
That's a tough one to answer because it's coming on the heels of AI models doubling in capability every, it seems like, 2 or 3 days. We're getting new models all the time. How much is the software, the AI, going to do? And how much is the quantum computing going to do? I don't know enough about quantum computing to know whether it's going to affect daily lives the way AI will. AI, quantum computing, as I think of it in today's terms, solving single problems with amazing efficiency, but not being used for general purpose kinds of things. But I need to learn a lot more about that. Maybe I'll use that in my sequel.
Oh, there you go. So back to your book.
Yeah.
So I'm always interested in the debut experience.
Okay.
Because everyone has an idea of what the writing experience is like. You said it took 7 years.
Yes.
What surprised you most about writing the book? Like, what was hard? What was easier?
Writing the book, never having written a novel before, I was scared going into it. My granddaughter convinced me that I could do it. So I just sat down and started doing it. Once I got over the initial fear, there wasn't really anything scary about it because I didn't have a deadline. I could take as long to write it as I wanted to take. So whenever I got overly anxious about something, I just stopped doing it and went and played with my dog, Augie, who, by the way, is the star of the children's version, Augie and the Tiny Little Sky Helpers.
Oh, that's great. But the
part of the process that's been most difficult for me came after the writing. I couldn't find an agent or a publisher because I was hitting right at the time, at least this is the excuse they gave me, I was hitting right at the time when all of the AI books were being submitted to agents and publishers. And they were inundated. They just, anything from a new writer, they just didn't have time for. So I ended up going the hybrid route, which today I would not recommend because you lose a lot of control. My book was published in December of last year. I have yet to get a report on how many books I've sold because the hybrid publisher maintains control over that information. And I'm expecting to get a check in the mail in the next couple or 3 days. I don't know how many zeros there will be in it.
So the,
if any.
I mean, that should be your royalty reporting in general should be in the contract, right? Whereas every six months it's quarterly.
It's quarterly.
Okay.
Yeah. Quarterly in arrears.
Okay, so yeah, so you should be getting that.
I mean, exactly.
I'm an ambassador for the Authors Guild.
Oh,
it tells me they do have like legal services.
You know? Cool.
So if you're not a member, you should join. But that's something when you're looking at contracts and things, you should look at. So beyond the control, I mean, hybrids can also be pretty expensive. What was it about the experience or that you would do differently next time? Say for the sequel for this, are you tied in with your contract?
No, I own the rights completely, and my entire. I'm going to work on the screenplay and hopefully the X Prize because if I'm a finalist, then I hope to produce a movie. Mm-hmm. So I expect to be working on that in the next year or two. For the sequel, I think I'll probably self-publish. I mean, who knows? I could come up with an agent as a result of submitting for the X Prize. But if it were today, mm-hmm. I would self-publish.
Is your daughter going to help you on with that? Because, I mean, it really is a different skill set.
It's actually my granddaughter.
Oh, your granddaughter.
And she just had a baby. So she's, I'll give her a pass for a while.
Might not be a bad idea to find a screenwriter to work with on that.
Oh, too, for
because
sure.
Because it's so different. You know, people who write short stories often have trouble with novels, and novelists can't write short stories. And
right.
Like, you just have to learn. It's a whole new art form.
It absolutely is. And I want to have a really good draft before I hand it to somebody who's going to butcherize it.
So after 7 years of working on this, you finally get your manuscript, you find a hybrid publisher,
right.
they put it together for you. What's that moment like when the book arrives and you actually open it up and you're holding your imagination in a physical form?
That was an amazing feeling. And in fact, the day that the book arrived, my wife, Sarah, went out and got me a pillow, a little throw pillow. that said, he's kind of a big deal.
I love
that. And that's how fantastic. It felt. I got over it, but that's how it felt.
It is a really big deal. I mean, yeah. Writing books is one of those things where it's over 80% of people say they want to do it.
Right.
And only 3% of them ever start and only 1% ever finish.
Really?
It's hard. I mean, it is. As you know, it took 7 years.
Right.
Like it's hard to write a book. And because we all read, I think, we think, oh, I know. We all kind of intuitively know how to accept story.
Sure.
But when you're writing it, it gets very complicated very quickly. Right.
Right.
How did you teach yourself like how to combine story arcs with character arcs? And like, how did you learn how to do this?
I don't think it's fair to say that I learned how to do it in any compact form. It was my life's experience and all my work experience. It became intuitive for me, but it was intuitive based on 60 years of stuff.
Did you always want to be a writer when you were younger?
No, I wanted to be a professor. Mm-hmm. No, actually, I wanted to be a senator. I got over that really young.
So at what point did this idea to write a novel, like when did that first occur to you?
All right. I was living in the Caribbean. And in fact, that's the first germ of the idea. My first morning at our new house in St. Croix, I went out on the lanai and I looked out. I could see the entire island from our house. We were at the top of a mountain. And I looked over this beautiful island and all of this sunlight and the trees, the palm trees waving in the breeze, not a single solar panel, not a single wind turbine. It's got sun and wind all the time. And we were paying 72 cents per kilowatt hour for electricity. When we lived in Old Town Alexandria, we were paying 8 cents. How they could do that just didn't make any sense to me. And I knew that I would have a mission to do something about that. So that was the first germ of the idea. And then I was in a really bad car accident and we had to move back to the States. And I was in a hospital bed in my son's basement and some very dear friends came by to visit. And she's a writer. And she said, well, you're going to be stuck in a bed for the next year, why don't you write a book? So I started.
So, I mean, you could, like, you're mission-driven. You could be writing articles, right? You could be
sure.
Writing a nonfiction book about it. There's
right.
A lot of ways to do this. Why novel?
Wow. No one has ever asked me that question. And I don't know if I've even asked myself that question. We were at a grandson's wedding down in New Orleans, and we were out on the terrace in this walk-up condo in New Orleans where they have the parades. And my granddaughter and I were talking, and we just got into that conversation about the why don't you write a book? And I was saying, I don't know how. She was saying, well, you used to write stuff for the government. Yeah, I did. So just write a book. And I had
what could be hard about that?
I had written scenarios as part of what I did as a futurist, and I had reviewed a thousand grant applications when I worked at Georgetown. So I thought, okay, what the heck? And I just sat down, and I was shocked at how quickly it started coming off my fingers.
Oh, that's great. That's a great feeling.
Yeah.
So when you're creating like characters, you're like, okay, I have to personalize this. I have to have personal stakes for people to care about so that I can talk to them about the broader issues.
Right.
How do you create your characters? Like how did you come up with this family and the individual characters within it?
Well, I knew I had to have a scientist because I had to have science. And I knew I had to have an AI person because we were going to have an android. In fact, I have two androids in the book. I don't know how many of you have read the book. But one's a good android and one's a bad android. One's a murder bot who violates the three laws of robotics from Asimov in the very first time you were introduced to her. The other one becomes the most human character in the book. So I knew I had to have the scientist and the AI person. And then I had to have someone drive the story from a human perspective. So that's how Elizabeth Lizzie and Jimmy were created. And then the dog is there for what kind of effect is it? Humorous effect.
It's or Save the Cat, right?
Well, I will tell you, I did use Save the Cat as a mental model. Again, not knowing anything about how to write a novel. I took a 2-hour course on Save the Cat. If you're not familiar, that's a novel writing technique that's also been applied now to movies. And it has 18 specific points in a book, the start, the middle, the end, all is lost, and that kind of formula. And I didn't follow it exactly, but I did. My first outline was Save the Cat. So again, to use terminology from the industry, if you're going to be a pantser, that is someone who writes by the seat of his or her pants, it's probably good to have some kind of outline, and Save the Cat's a good one.
So how in-depth in the outline did you go?
Not all that deep. I wanted to start with a storm that scares the family to death. And so once I had them in the cistern, in the basement of their house, it was pretty easy to get the emotions running from that.
So you mentioned like the 18 story beats. Did you have these as like signposts? Were you shooting for certain things? Did you have scenes like at the end? Did you know the ending? Did you have this in mind as you were writing?
I did.
Oh, interesting.
I knew the ending was about hope. Mm-hmm. No question in my mind about that. How we were going to get to that, I didn't know. Something you just said triggered me. What was it? I'm having a mental
about the
moment.
Outlining we're talking about, and having a signpost along the way, something so some direction where you're headed.
I've lost it.
All right, well, we can.
This is why I had a pad of paper to write myself notes that I haven't taken.
That's fine. So when you're, how'd you name the characters? Like, I'm always curious because these characters have to come to life, right? And people have to care about them,
right?
So you have like the tropes, who has each role in this and the archetypes that you're using. Then how do you make them human?
Well, for Greg, the scientist, his name is Gregory Peck Marshall, from the actor in my favorite movie of all time, To Kill a Mockingbird. Jenny was Virginia, a family name. We have lots of Virginias hanging around. Lizzie was Elizabeth, which is the most prevalent family name. James was also a family name, named after my grandson. Other people, I named one of the bad guys after the comedian Jonathan Winters. Yeah. So I gave people names that I had some emotional resonance with. And so when I'm writing about them, that was kind of there in the background.
Do you plan out their character arcs and how they change over the course of the story?
Not so much. I did with the two kids in particular, and with Valeda, the good android.
Let's talk about your process a little bit. So you have this outline, you start writing. It's over 7 years. Were you trying to write every day, or were you just writing when the spirit moved you?
I was writing when the spirit moved me.
And when you would sit down to write, did you give yourself parameters? Was it I'm gonna write the scene today, or I'm just gonna write until I'm tired? Or what?
It was pretty much, I want to get this scene. I want to end up with this emotion that I leave with.
And where did you write?
Most of it I wrote in Haymarket, Virginia. Not all that far from here.
Did you write like in an office, or did you?
I wrote in my kitchen.
Daniel Silva writes lying on the floor. Yeah. You know, like everyone's got their own thing. So you're in your kitchen.
Yeah.
Did you need to be alone, or could you have people around you while you were writing?
Oh, I could totally ignore people if they were around me. My wife is nodding her head.
Was there a certain time of day when you wrote?
No. In fact, there were some days when months when I wrote nothing at all. And there were some days when I wrote 18 hours.
So, wow, that's incredible. How much did that tire you out writing for 18 hours? Because it takes a lot of mental energy.
Well, I would do this scene And then I would go work on this character. I would break up the kinds of things I was doing. It's kind of like what I'm doing right now. I'm working on a trailer for the movie. I'm working on the screenplay for the movie. I'm working on a children's book based on Whitegrass. And I'm thinking about the sequel. And I go back and forth from one to the other. Last night I was working on the screenplay. I'm able to juggle, and it keeps my brain active until I finally say I can't do this anymore.
Is there anything you use to access your creativity? Like, do you listen to music, or are there any rituals you have that help you get into the right headspace?
iPhone, Facebook, LinkedIn, X. I get a lot of good science from LinkedIn and Facebook and X.
So you're researching things and getting ideas that then get you going into the book.
Exactly. And politics. Politics keeps me very busy these days.
It can take up a lot of time, right?
Yes.
If you're on social media, how do you balance spending time on social media and writing or getting on all these projects you're working on simultaneously?
Yeah. And making sure that I don't put something on Facebook that'll get me arrested. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would interfere with the completion of these projects for sure. So,
by the way, the book is apolitical. Mm-hmm. You can be conservative or liberal; it doesn't make any difference. I will give a tiny little spoiler, and that is that the president of the United States is involved, and I don't know whether you're going to like her or not. Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't please people when you write a book, right?
Like,
you have to write the story you want to tell. And no matter what it is, you're going to have people who like or dislike. So this came out in December. So what is your feedback been like since this came out?
I've gotten 34 reviews on Amazon, which I think is fairly good for a brand new book for a brand new author. Mm-hmm. And it's a 4.4 score. That was brought down by one person who gave it a 1 and said it was the weirdest book they'd ever read. And almost everybody else has been a 4 or 5.
Well, weird is good, right? Like, being different tends to be good. At least you didn't get the 1 star because the book arrived late or something.
Right.
That tends to happen.
But so far, the feedback has been excellent.
Is it strange to have people you don't know talking about your book?
No, it's fun. Because I want to know what they got from it. Mm-hmm. And I usually don't correct them. I mean, if there was something else that comes along later on that they haven't got to, I might point them towards it. But
are you interacting with people? If it's on Amazon, you can't, right? But
right.
If are you interacting with readers? How are you doing that? How are you going back and forth?
My feedback has been going to a marketing person that I have, and she's been working on my trailer. So I'm not having feedback from her on the feedback from, I'm sorry. Oh, I almost had a note from the audience, from the peanut gallery. So I'm not having that much direct interaction. We had a fun time at a farmer's market the other day, that kind of thing.
When you're doing this, you're going out, you're talking, right? Are you doing like festivals and that kind of thing too? So are you enjoying that process? Like, is it fun to be in front of people talking about these issues? Or because a lot of writers are more introverted too, right?
Right.
And they don't enjoy that interaction. So it's very different from the writing experience.
I enjoy the interaction. I don't get that much traffic at these shows. The farmer's market we were at the other day, the person next to me is a writer of children's books. Mm-hmm. And she had 4 beautifully illustrated books that were published by National Geographic. Mm-hmm. Everybody at the farmer's market was coming over and talking to her. Nobody was coming over and talking to me. So that's not the most enjoyable experience.
That happens.
Right.
That happens. I mean, New York Times, #1 bestsellers will go to Barnes & Noble and nobody will come over. There's a thing that's interestingly, right, for if people start coming over, it will draw a crowd. But if nobody comes over, no one wants to be that first person that comes stand in front of that.
And I did get some of her seconds.
Yeah, well, good. So have you found anything that works in marketing or that works in getting the word out? Because, I mean, there were 4 million books that came out last year. So it's a huge increase.
I don't have any data to judge that on. Mm-hmm. I would totally be guessing if I answered that.
Do you have a website? Where should people who are watching this go to find you?
I do. It's www.whitegrassnovel.com. Mm-hmm. And you can, one thing that I know what it was that I forgot earlier that I should have taken the note about.
Good. Good timing.
You were asking about where things fit in the process, where you put different parts of the book and stuff like that. And using Save the Cat. Mm-hmm. And my midpoint was stretching further and further and further towards the end of the book. And I had too much material in there, but I didn't want to lose any of it. So I took one chapter and pulled it out and turned it into a prequel.
Oh, fun.
Which I have copies of for everyone here.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, that's fun. When you're seeing it, were you writing in Word or Scrivener? What were you writing?
I was writing it in Word.
Okay. So, I mean, it's hard.
No. I wrote most of it on, what is it? The internet version of Word.
Pages or... You were on a Mac, right?
I was on a Mac, right? I don't even remember. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
I know how to find it, but I don't remember what.
Let's see. Are there any questions anybody has they'd like to ask?
The question was, I've found that different age groups relate differently to different parts of the book. Guys my age tend to want to talk about Valeda, the good android. Younger people, teenagers in particular, want to talk about the murder bot because she's a lot of fun.
Should that concern us?
Yes. people in younger women tend to talk more about the mom, Liz, Jenny. I think people kind of sit where they stand or what, however that saying goes, stand where they sit.
Any other questions? All right. Well, this has been really fun.
Hey,
thank you
been
so
great.
Much.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Take care.